Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I pulled rank today. There was a discussion that lasted all of about 3 seconds over who was going to record this one. And I went, no, I'm having it. Why did I decide to pull rank, Alex?
I just find it funny that you did pull rank because it meant that you sort of effectively rugby tackled Lockie out of the way and won, which would never happen in real life. You pulled rank because our guest today, I think you and him have got a bit of a mutual boy crush going on. I mean, he wants you for your Wellington brain and I don't know, maybe you just like his big shiny head. It is, of course, Peter Hart, who's an idiot, but when it comes to real life and like common sense and stuff like that, but when it comes to World War One, he's quite bright actually. And actually he does a bit of the wrong war as well. And now he's going backwards into the 19th century, but that's not why we're here today. We're here today because today, Zach, is the anniversary of the Gallipoli landings. And we're going to give Peter a chance to rant about it, but we're not going to talk about the actual landings. If you would like to learn about the landings, the latest Great War Group magazine is themed the Gallipoli landings. But we're here today. The title of the podcast is Genesis of Failure. We're going to give Petey a chance to rant. Hello, Petey.
Hello. It's a delight to be here with such lovely people.
That's really not.
And to talk about the Great War, as we historians call it.
Is he always this charming?
No. Only when he wants
them. Even.
See, I always blame this one on your granddad, Alex. So I might end up being educated and expose myself as a bit of a cretin.
Now, granddad's going to take a bit of a beating today, but he's not the only one, is he, Petey? But
he certainly is not the only one.
We set the scene for people. The end of 1914, Britain is engaged to the limit of her military capacity on the Western Front, isn't she? And beyond, why and how?
Well, it's perfectly simple. Britain was a naval power and didn't have a proper army, which is often the case. So we had 4 divisions ready to go, another 2 ready to go within a couple of weeks. But we were not a military power. The navy, whilst that was big, because the German fleet, the high seas fleet, could pick its moment to attack. That meant that we had to be ready at worst case against their best case. So although we had a naval superiority, it was narrow, much narrower than the raw figures show. So we were at the limits of our capacity. I think that's we couldn't really deliver much more than we were already doing. The new armies were being raised, Kitchener's army, the territorials were starting to come to the Western Front by the end of 14. But it's a slow process. In many ways, it takes 2 years before the British are on land involved in the war proper.
Is that a hang-up from kind of colonial era, army going to be a police force to keep the colonies in check sort of thing? Is that the kind of the legacy?
It is. And it's also a legacy of the fact that British politicians are only willing to pay for one major service. And the Navy is expensive. And campaigns like that, was it, we want 8 and we won't wait for dreadnoughts, were excruciatingly expensive. And it is a political decision as well. It's, you know, the army doesn't say, oh, we're going to be this size. It's set by the budgets, in a sense, that are allowed. And our country was not willing to do it.
Come November, though, Turkey enters the war, right? And if I remember this correctly, both sides were kind of hoping that they might manage to get Turkey to intervene on their side. Probably completely wrong, and I've exposed myself as an idiot there. But what kind of impact? What kind of impact does it have?
I used to have a friend who, whenever she said "not at all," she meant yes.
I'm used to the abuse on this show. Don't worry.
I bet you are. No, well, it's very interesting the way Turkey comes into the war, because Britain sort of wanted her to come in on, but made no real efforts. There was no diplomatic overtures, and we stole their battleships. They had two battleships being, don't ask me their names, no one in their right mind would remember them, being manufactured in British shipbuilding yards. They were almost ready, and we took them without asking. We took them because, as I said, the naval margins are narrower than they look. But this then exposes us. If Turkey comes into the war, the Ottoman Empire, I always call it Turkey and Turks, so I just better warn you, it's correctly Ottomans, but bugger that. If they come into the war, all the things that people put in favour of Gallipoli are thrown into doubt by Churchill, the First Lord of the Admiralty's decision to take their battleships, which really annoys the Turks, really does annoy them. And the Germans capitalise on it by sending the Goeben and the Breslau, who were floating about in the Mediterranean, through the Dardanelles, and they were then signed up to the Turkish Navy in a sort of... and this sort of, from then on, there's only one side they're going to come in on. And it's duly manoeuvred between the German Turkish war minister, Enver Pasha, and Suchet's commanding the Goeben, and then the Turkish fleet, that the Goeben and other Turkish units bombard Russian forts. However, before we declare war, after this, but before we formally declare war, Churchill orders units of our fleet to bombard the entrance to the Dardanelles, thus warning everybody of what's likely to happen, which is another church. So before the Dardanelles even starts, Churchill's made what could be considered two really big mistakes. One, to steal their battleships and allow the Goeben and Breslau to escape from the Mediterranean. And two, or three, depending on how you look at it, to bombard the outer forts, thus warning that we have an interest in what's going on there. So it's not just the genesis of the campaign. It reaches back, as you rightly imply in your question. Well, brilliant.
So I remember that one of the boats is called the Sultan Osman, and that I don't know how to pronounce the other one because it's a Turkish word.
Razi something.
Razi or something like that. Anyway, before we embark on how we ended up facing Turkey at the Dardanelles, what does Turkey entering the war, what's the biggest threat for Britain? Because it's not the Dardanelles, is it? Why are we scared of Turkey?
Well, there's two main threats. There's one geopolitical threat, and that is that Turkey is the Ottoman Empire is a Muslim country, and half the British Empire is Muslim, including the jewel in the crown, India, which is partly Muslim, it's partly Hindu as well, as you know. That can lead to trouble. So there's that, there's Egypt, there's all sorts of our colonies that have Muslims living there. And the Turks declare a holy war. So there is this very real fear about what might happen. So that's a sort of geopolitical thing. And that does impact on Kitchener's views about failure and the Gallipoli later on in the campaign. But in some ways, more immediate, where the Turks can directly threaten the Suez Canal, the route to India. And that they can do if they can manage to cross a 90-mile desert. Which is doubtful. They also threaten the oil supplies. There's no British oil supplies are based around Mesopotamia or Persia, actually, but the route through is through Abadan and Mesopotamia. And the Turks could threaten that route. It is interesting that before Gallipoli had started, both these threats had been overcome. The Turks made an attack in February and it had been smashed. In fact, yeah, it was an incredible achievement.
It's important to say that, isn't it? That actually this isn't, when we do pick a fight with them, it's not because we have no choice, because they've already tried the Suez Canal and it was a bit sad, their attempt, wasn't it?
Well, it was very brave, and they've got across the canal, and they dragged pontoons right across the 90 miles of the desert. They behaved with incredible fortitude. They got across, they wouldn't surrender. They fought their very good defensive troops, the Turks. And that should have been a bit of a key assigned to people, but it wasn't. And they'd also, we'd launched the Mesopotamia campaign and had already secured the oil by December 1914. It was absolutely, we then go on for a mad Mesopotamian campaign and could have lost everything, but that's it was secured in December 1914. So it, the two main threats had been dealt with. The Turks couldn't really do anything to us.
So I think what the point that we're trying to get across here is that there's not really any need for an offensive at this point against the Turks. But Zach, take us on.
I just have a question off the back of all of this. Why are people looking elsewhere if it's kind of been done and dusted in these other theatres? Because you've got a whacking great front in the form of the Western Front. There's quite obviously a gridlock there. Have they just kind of given up on the Western Front and they're sort of looking to other places as a quick solution to a problem that can't really be solved at that moment in time?
Well, it is. It's the fight against Germany on the Western Front is the main front. There is another main front, which is of equal importance, although not as the war turned out, on the Eastern Front. And it's good to remember that. It proves not to be the most important front because, as we know, the Russians collapsed in 17. So clearly that wasn't the decisive front. The decisive front was and would be the Western Front. And everything else... But it was tough. The German army was incredibly well organized. They made mistakes. Their cavalry was dreadful. They made mistakes, but they fought hard. And it was clearly going to be a long and painful war. Now, who is it who always looks for easy, quick solutions? Is it A, generals, or B, politicians? And the answer to this is politicians. And it's the political classes, the chattering classes, who start to worry about the futility of the Western Front. The generals know that if they abandon France, the Germans will occupy the coastline, and they'll control Europe for the foreseeable future, and they will be well poised to launch an assault across the Channel at some point in the future. This is, Zach, your specialities in Napoleonic Wars. You will recognise all these statements as being eternal British foreign policy interests until we all started supporting the Russians and until they attacked Ukraine. But, you know, that's our current political leadership. But these are the eternal things. But the Easterners, as they became known, there's the Westerners who believe in the proper thing, the logistic logistically, it makes sense to fight on the Western Front, which is close by. It's not far from London. But they look to the east, and they make a group of claims which are ludicrous. The first one is it would knock Turkey out of the war. This is the idea that Turkey was propping one of the allies, the Central Powers, propping up Germany. They claim it would influence the wavering Balkan states into joining the Allies and Italy. Well, it could be said it did with Italy. Whether you think the Balkans can work together on anything is up to you. Release pressure from Russia. At this point, in December 1914, the Russians have run into trouble in the Caucasus. And although this doesn't last long, they actually request help as a distraction and to sort of try and weaken Turkey. In actual fact, General Winter and the Turks' incompetence means that the Russians actually win that campaign and there's no need for it whatsoever. But my favourite realised, release pressure from Russia, that's fine, but open a sea route for the South Russian ports in the Black Sea, which would allow the export of munitions to feed the Russian guns. This is in 1915, when we can't even feed our own guns on the Western Front. It's ludicrous. And the obverse is to allow the import of grain from Russia. Well, that sounds feasible, because we can't feed ourselves, never could. But hang on a minute. What's one of the causes of the Russian Revolution? The Russian railway system couldn't move food and troops. So a lot of the big cities started to starve. There is no way of getting the grain. What about the submarines on the route? Have we got destroyers for escorting all these ships to go through the Mediterranean? Who's that in the Mediterranean? Oh, the Austrians. Are they on our side? No. Have they got a navy? Yes. Do you see what I mean? There's all these ludicrous, ludicrous things. And if the Central Powers were going to be defeated, if Germany, that's the real one, is going to be defeated, it has to be on the Western Front. But the visionaries, Churchill, Lloyd George, and most, if not all, in fact all, because they all voted for it, all the cabinet eventually sign off on an assault on Turkey. I do rabbit on, so just shut me up if I...
No, it's all good. You've just led us perfectly into our next question, which is, so we've talked about Churchill a bit. So for those of World War II people listening, this is a skinnier, younger version of Churchill with slightly more hair, but just as much belligerence. He is a major character in this. You've mentioned the cabinet. Lloyd George is another key one. He's an Easterner, isn't he? Who else have we got? We've got Fisher as well, haven't we? Who later claims that he always thought this was a terrible idea and goes loopy.
Well, Fisher is the first Sea Lord, i.e. the professional head of the Navy. And he bears the imprint of the last person to sit on him. So if he's been talking to Jellicoe, who's the commander of the Grand Fleet, he will. I mean, Jellicoe's banging on about needing all his battle cruisers, about banging on about destroyers, which they desperately need. He said, we have to keep our fleet at home. But if he talks to Churchill, Churchill is brilliant. There's no doubt he's a brilliant politician. What's Fisher's weakness? His age. So when does he hold meetings with Fisher? He keeps him up till 2 or 3 in the morning. Fisher can't cope with it. Fisher vacillates between one view and the other. There's no clear guidance from the professionals of that. And the problem is that the chief of Imperial General Staff, who is, oh God, I can't remember, Murray, one of the Murrays, there's about 8 Murrays, I can't remember which one it is also pretty useless. But people like Haig, Sir John French, they're going, don't do it, stick to the Western Front. But their politicians do not listen to their military advisors, which is a bit unfortunate, really.
We're going to move on to discuss Gallipoli in a second, but this isn't the only sort of slightly stupid idea that's floating about, is it? So tell us about some of the others.
Well, they're just barking mad. You'd think they'd... Churchill was particularly keen on taking Borkum and Sylt Islands, which he wanted to establish a destroyer base on as a forward base to harass the thing. This would have led to a slaughter of whoever was put in charge of it. Even more lunatic, him and Fisher both favoured landings on the North Baltic German coast. I don't know whether you can imagine. In fact, they did something. If you can imagine what would happen to them. What would have happened to them if they had tried that against Napoleon in 1918, what's it? And you could just see they'd be isolated and destroyed. It's a mad scheme. They even planned landings on the Belgian and Dutch coasts. It's interesting that our perception of neutrality can be as dodgy as the German at times.
Nikolai and I are going to do a whole thing at the conference in October about how there's no such thing as neutrality in the First World War.
Well, certainly we. I mean, these plans didn't go anywhere because everybody just said you're mad,
and rightly so.
Rightly so. So there's all these schemes, but the essence of all of them is they're looking for an easier way. They're looking for a way where the Navy can play more of a part. They're looking for a way to evade the terrible sort of stalemate, as they saw it, and the suffering that they saw lay ahead over the next few years on the Western Front. My view is that suffering was unavoidable once you get into the Great War. If you're fighting the Germans, you have to kill about 2 million of them before they'll give in. And the British Army are going to have to play their part. It's a terrible, nasty business.
Just away from the Baltic as well, because you know I never, ever pass up a chance to slag off Lloyd George, also known as Satan Spawn and the little Welsh demon. His plan, I love his plan. His plan is, let's just take everyone from the Western Front and dump them in the Adriatic and they'll start a new front there and win the war in like a week.
I think they'd drown.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, I can't. What is he even? Well, he's not qualified.
But all these, it's no worse than the other ones. I think the worst one is landing on the North German coast, and
that one is quite hilarious. Yeah,
I mean that is suicide.
Let's stick where all of their massive naval bases are and start a fight there.
I think, you see, why does the Dardanelles plan win out? And the thing is, although I think the Dardanelles plan is stupid and seriously at fault, it's probably the best of that list of plans we've just been through. It does have some hopes, although in my view, very little hope of success. It's just not clinically insane as most of the other ones are.
So Churchill manages to get it through because he promises or basically he says it's all going to be naval, doesn't he? That's how he manages to do it. He sells the idea.
That's it. And they're going to bombard and conquer the bombard and take the Gallipoli Peninsula. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's a phrase that a fleet clearly can't do. By the way, they can bombard it, but they can't take it. He bullies the local admiral, which is Admiral Carden, who is in a psychologically weakened state already. He bullies him into trying. They start a campaign in February, and it works through in stages until March 18th of 1915. Now, this is the big day for me. This is the only day when there was any real chance of a Dardanelles campaign succeeding. I'd say they had about a 5% chance of success, which is higher than everything else that they did. They basically launch an Anglo-French fleet. It's a classic Gallipoli plan because we seem to be taking the lead. Our best ships go in the first line. The French ships go in the second line. And our worst ships in the third line. And that sounds fair. But the scheme is we bombard until the forts seem to be possibly slowing down their rate of fire. Then the French should pass through and engage them closely at close range. This, of course, means that the French get an absolute torrent of fire because the Turks basically stop firing every so often just only when there's a really good target. And they lose the Bouvet in, I think it's 2.5 minutes.
There's a lot of Gallic shrugging going on in our direction at Gallipoli from the French, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. The French only there really to watch us. They don't trust us. They may be our allies, but they've been our enemies right up. The Fashoda crisis was only a few years before when we considered vaguely going to war with them. The French are not our eternal allies. They were our allies then.
And we were getting closer and closer to the Middle East, aren't we? Which is where we clash massively in ambition-wise. So, I mean, rightly so. They are hanging around like a fart in a lift watching everything we do in that region.
They are. They want Syria. In particular, which is why they're not keen on us landing in Syria, for instance, which is one of the proposals. There's proposals that the Greeks will send an army of 50,000 to join with us to take the whole thing. the Greek government proposed, well, Venizelos, I'm not sure that's how you pronounce his name. I think that's a town. Anyway.
Venizelos, isn't it? I don't know.
That's him. He's the prime minister. Yeah. He proposed it, but the king, who's pro-German, stamps on it. And the Russians say, oh no, you don't. We're not having the Greeks take Constantinople, thank you, Istanbul, of course. So this is all going off. It's just a mess, a whole mess, the whole thing. And eventually what emerges is the attack on the 18th. We lose a third of the fleet. I think three ships are sunk. Can't remember. We lose six ships anyway. They're put out of action one way or another, which is a third of the 18. We achieve nothing. And one quote that says, you know, you have to break eggs to make an omelette. But if you break all the eggs and you still haven't made the omelette, it's not you're not doing too well, are you?
I mean,
and that's what it is. And people keep saying Churchillian apologists, and they are legion because of his career as a great Second World War leader. Whether you think he was great in the Second World War is down to you. He is popularly considered to be great. And so his apologists, like Robert Roach, James Orlow, they all will say, oh, the Turks are running out of ammunition. If only they'd tried again. Except the Turks weren't running out of ammunition. They had enough. They had enough. And we only had two-thirds of ships. I'll tell you who was running out of ammunition. We were. Because our logistical chain goes all the way back to Portsmouth, etc., which is a long way away. And the admiral, who by then, de Roebuck, had taken over from John de Roebuck, had taken over from poor old Carden, who'd gone home loopy. Well, ill, not well. He just says, no, we can't do it. Admiral Key, Commander Keyes, Roger Keyes, who was an idiot of the highest order, for the rest of his career, said if only they'd attacked next day, they'd have got through and the world of the war would have been over and Constantinople would have surrendered as soon as the British arrived because they're cowards, them Turks. Yeah, it's just all rubbish.
Yeah, speaking of the Turks, you mentioned the 18th of March there. They rightly remember that as a day of glory for them in terms of, because we are invading them or trying to invade them. And they're defending their homeland. And the 18th of March, they worship that date, don't they?
They do, and if you go in through the straits, it's got big things on the side of the hillsides. One thing about the Turks is just remember that they started it.
Yeah.
They bombarded the Russians first. They go on a bit, all this invaded our homeland, and we're completely innocent, just sat there doing nothing, and the British and French invaded. They'd invade, they bombarded Russia. But yes.
So tell Berlin that in August when we get there.
Well, no, I think Berlin, York must know this for well and true. The Turks aren't innocent, but then the British and French aren't innocent either. We have our eyes on breaking up the Turkish Empire. So whatever the excuse, we've got a darker side. We want Mesopotamia. The French want Syria. The Russians want Constantinople, Istanbul. There's everybody's got motives. So there's reasons why the Turks, driven to desperation, grab on the German alliance and attack the Russians. So I'm not too down on them.
Has nobody thought about the fact that, you know, hang on, lads, we bombarded some of the outer forts a little while back, kind of leaving a calling card, and they might have had a think about how this might go down in future and done something about their defence? Has nobody thought that through from an intelligence perspective?
I'm sure some of the admirals did. I doubt the politicians did. They intended to do it in stages and then tried to rush all the stages together on the 18th. The problem is naval gunnery is not suited to attacking land forts. It's flat trajectory, and forts tend to be up a hill or behind. They had lots and lots of howitzers behind a hill, so you can't get them at all. You have to actually hit the magazine. Strangely enough, on the 5th or 6th of November, when they'd done the first bombardment, they'd actually blown up a fort. They'd blown up Sedd el Bahr. But that was just luck. They never blew anything else up as long as they tried. So it's just one of those things. It's just awful, really.
So, unfortunately, dumbass politicians are in charge of this. If you're a mover and shaker in the war cabinet, what do your options look like now? You failed to do this using the Navy like you plan to.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? I mean, this is where Kitchener starts to take an edge more blame. I'm quite an admirer of Kitchener, although he doesn't have the greatest First World War.
At this point, though, he has been saying this is stupid and you're not having troops for this.
However, he is known as the Sirdar from Egypt, India. He doesn't want to lose publicly to a Muslim power because he feels that the subjugated, and remember, they're not all cheery, they don't all want British control. This idea that Britain is a benevolent, lovely country that everybody laughs in India, I'm being Gary now, and Egypt and Burma and all the other places that we've conquered and subjugated. And I think subjugated is the right word. They're looking for a chance often to revolt or to make their feelings felt. That doesn't mean the Indian Army wasn't loyal, by the way. I'm not saying that. And it's a very important force. But Kitchener fears the reaction. He fears a mutiny. He fears all sorts of things. And again, I just want to remind you, time passes. Halfway between your Napoleonic period and the Great War is the Indian Mutiny in the 1850s. Which was still part of popular memory. People were still alive who'd been there and had experienced it. And so there was this great fear of losing face. And there's one other thing as well, which I'm tempted to ask you as the question, but I mean, I'm supposed to be answering them. But there was one other thing that British planners in planning a land campaign had always in front of them. And that is that we are the British and the Turks are Johnny Turks and they're useless. They'll run away if we can get. We might suffer casualties getting ashore, but they won't stand up to the British guts and bulldog spread.
I mean,
and as soon as they get ashore with our trusty bayonets, they'll run because they don't like it up them.
It is. That useless, fuzzy-wuzzy, racist brown troops are inferior to white troops bullshit, isn't it?
Unless they're trained by the British and actually Indian or Gurkha, in which case, of course, they become British.
Exactly. But
I mean, it's the sheer stupidity of the idea that Turkish troops are useless. Yeah, they'd had a bad time in the Balkan Wars, but that was only 2 years before. They'd learned a lot. A lot of their troops had gained experience. What they were, and they even in the Korean War, 50 years later, they had the reputation. They were superb defensive troops. They would not give up. They were good. All the crap that we shoot 15 rounds a minute and every other country can only shoot one. It's just bollocks. They're well-trained. They're good at musketry. In fact, at Gallipoli, once we got ashore, we found they could put a bullet through the sniper's plate, through the hole in the sniper's plate from 100 yards. The Turks, they're not useless. They're well-trained infantry. And funnily enough, do you know what? A lot of the troops we landed were not well-trained infantry. And shall I just run through the troops at Kitchener and Mamasse?
29th Division. Tell us, plan-wise, what is the plan then, and who are they sending?
Well, let's have a force generation again, because things don't change. When you're generating a force in the Napoleonic time, do you, A, send any old troops that are just around, or do you try and send troops that are suited to the job? And the answer is usually you try and suit the job, the troops to the job. Well, 29th Division, oh, it sounds good. It's a regular division. But is it? It's scraped up from around the empire. Half the Mad Vidi, that's a callous. I don't know why I said that. But they were from all around the empire. They've been back. They'd not trained as a division. They'd not fought as a division. They'd not done anything as a division. They didn't have their own artillery. They were not a division. The Anzac Corps, Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, Anzac for short, good, great material, but no real training, no experience. The Royal Navy Division, my personal favourite, were vastly incompetent at the start. They'd already had the Antwerp disaster. They were good, good material, but they didn't know what they were doing. They had no artillery, so they are not a division. Royal Naval bunch of infantry would have been a better description. The 42nd Division, which come in the early stages, they're a TA unit. They'd had a lot of training in Egypt, but it was not adequate. And all of them were woefully inadequate in artillery munition supply. There were, however, two divisions in the early days that were well organized. Can you think who they are, Alex?
Oh. Is it the French, Peterkins?
It is the French who sent two divisions, one immediately and one following up. And the thing about them was they had plenty of artillery, unlike all of the British divisions, and plenty of ammunition for munitions for said guns, which we didn't. And the reason for this is the French, who had been fighting various people for some time, Zach, you may not be aware of this from your Napoleonic studies. There's a clue in the word Napoleon, isn't there? They were quite used to running a war, and they had ammunition and guns because they knew they'd need them. And they're well-trained troops. So, but it's a disaster in the making. The naval campaign's a failure. They've got, according to Kitchener and other politicians, they cannot lose face, so they're going to have to go in. They're going to have to go in, and who's the mug that's going to lead them?
So who's the poor schmuck who's lumbered with all of this and has got to make it happen? Because it's not Churchill, is it? He's out of the picture in terms of, you know, you said the Navy. Navy didn't work. You can shut up. So who's left to deal with it?
Well, the only person is the Army, as usual, the divisions I've mentioned. And they're under the command of General Sir Ian Hamilton, who is a very, very distinguished soldier. And now the Germans reckoned he was the most experienced general in the world. I've got a few things. I'm not pretending that I remember this, so I'm looking at a list.
Yeah.
He was born in 1853, so he was very old at 61, which is 6 years younger than me. He'd been in the Second Afghan War, 1878 to 80. He'd been in the First Boer War, 1880 to 81, where at Majuba Hill he'd been recommended for the VC but was too junior and wasn't given it. He'd been in the Nile operations of 1884-5. He'd been at the Chitral expedition. I have to be careful how I say that. The Chitral expedition of 1895. Don't ask me where it is either because I've forgotten. He'd been in the Terrar expedition, which I never did know where that was. That was 1887-8. He'd been in the Boer War proper, 1899 to 1902, where he'd had a brilliant war. Unlike most British generals, he'd had a very, very good war, working with Kitchener, which where their foundation of their relationship. had been the official observer of the Russo-Japanese. This is a really, really experienced man. He was hoping to get command of the BEF, but he hadn't been given. He'd been left in command of troops in England, and now he was given Gallipoli. He was the poor schmuck, as Alex would describe him, who was saddled with trying to make something impossible work. I do not blame him for failure. I do blame him for several other things.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think I have tempered my opinion from what a knob to he is a knob, but he was a knob on a hiding to nothing.
I'm not sure I'm going to go with a knob. I think he's just a bloke given an impossible job. And one of the things about the British generals of the time, him, the commander of 29th Division and later 8th Corps, Hunter Weston, Aylmer Hunter Weston, people like this have a can-do mentality. And the trouble with a can-do mentality is if you can't do it, and clearly can't do it, then it just leads to needless casualties, needless slaughter. But if you're getting ordered by politicians back at home, you are in a cleft stick. You are, they're saying, go on then, go on. So you try, you lose more men, you try again. Oh, God, we send us more. You're buggered, to use a highly technical army term.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody forced Hunter Bunter to light that mine up at the most stupid time possible on the 1st of July on the Somme.
There's a story about that. If you read my book, you'd see that there is a reason why it happened. And
written a book about the Somme? I didn't even know. You know I use it to kill spiders because it's massive.
I do. I'm scared of spiders. I get Polly to kill spiders.
I use your book. I throw that book at them. And it's only the paperback and it still kills them. But obviously, the Gallipoli landings, as I say, if your interest is Pete, the new Great War Group magazine is going to go into this in great depth. And Pete's written a brilliant article about the French for that. That'll be a whole other podcast. But just briefly breaking it down, the plan itself. So strategically, we have issues with them making this landing, but the tactical planning is shit, isn't it?
I think, often books will say Hamilton's plan was brilliant. It wasn't. What he does is he lands troops at Anzac Cove, which is halfway up the peninsula. That's one separate operation. He then lands, he has five, I think, landings. At Helles. He has a French landing to cover the arses of the Helles landing the other side of the straits. Which is conducted by the French. He has a French diversion at Bazooka Bay. He has a British diversion by the Royal Naval Division towards the Blair Straits. It's just, he has here, there, every bloody where. What he does is that they're all interlinked operations, but they're all separate. Even at Helles, where they're just round the peninsula with V and W, X and Y. And then S. There are five. They are too far apart to support each other. There's no communication because communications at the time weren't up to it. Wireless communications could have a delay of an hour and a half by the time it's got from where it's sent to where it's going through various bits and bobs. The Turks, you have something just in time ordering by supermarkets. The Turks are just about able to cope with what's happening. But the other thing is, there's a gross overestimate of Turkish forces. So they've only got one company facing the Anzacs before a couple of regiments arrive. And the British at Helles, the whole of those five landings facing the whole, basically, of the 29th Division is only opposed by one Turkish battalion. That's just 1,000 men plus another platoon from the other, but never mind that. And this means that when the Turks launch some sort of minor, because they like German control in German theories, so they always counterattack. If they launch a platoon attack, we think there's 1,000, 2,000 men coming, and we get scaredy and stop doing what we're doing and often retreat. But there are only a few men, and it hampers them almost as much as the actual Turkish heroes, a 3rd 26th Regiment there. And do you know, these may have been the first landings made in the face of modern weapons, which I think they are, I think, if you think about it. But the British
and that includes the Anzacs. The Anzacs are part of the British Army at the time. Could hardly have done worse, or the Turks much better on the 25th of April, because we fail pretty well everywhere. At V Beach, we capture about 10 feet of ground. W Beach, we make a minor incursion. Y Beach, we make a small incursion and have our arses kicked out. X Beach, we don't really do anything. S Beach, we don't really do anything. At Anzac, we managed to get inland, but not as far as we were meant to get. And then the Turks counterattacks forces. But everywhere, it's just a tale of, well, the Turks have done brilliantly and we're held. And you're going to be in. The Gallipoli campaign is going to be one of stalemate, pain and suffering, a bit like the Western Front, really. It's not an easy option, and it never was going to be. Terrible.
Am I right in thinking that we never actually reached day one objectives over the entirety of the Gallipoli campaign?
The day one objective was a thing called Achi Baba, which was a hill about 6 miles in. It is a dominant tactical feature. That was meant to be captured on the first day. The second day, the real tactical objective of Kilid Bahir, that's the massive plateau ridge that dominates the actual narrows. Well, we never even mention that again. And often Gallipoli accounts by Hamilton and Churchill apologists will erase that because it shows how we never got anywhere near it. That was meant to be taken on day two. Day three, the fleet would pass through the strait and everyone would have beer and skittles. And everyone would be happy. And then they'd go to Constantinople and the cowardly Turks would just surrender. That was it. But in actual fact, the whole campaign of 8 months, we never get further than about 400 yards in front of Krithia, which is a poxy little village. It's basically, if you look at it, we're trying to get Constantinople, Istanbul, aren't we? Can't do that. To get that, we have to get through the straits. But we can't get through the straits unless we capture Kilid Bahir. But we can't capture Kilid Bahir. First, we have to capture Achi Baba. But we can't capture Achi Baba. So first, we have to capture this poxy village. It's called Al-Sitepi now. No disrespect to it. It's where people live and work and have their lives. But as a tactical objective...
lots of ice cream as well when we're there.
Yeah, I love ice cream. But as a tactical objective, it's doesn't mean it. It's just a few...
Yeah,
but we can't capture even Krithia. We have three battles of Krithia, and then we start calling it by date. It's always a shoot. We're not the Italians who go 19th Battle of the Isonzo. We have the sense to change it to date.
Before we can't capture. Embarrassing, right?
Yeah. So we can't after the third, but we can't capture Krithia either. So we start trying to capture the vineyard, which is a vineyard just in front of it. We can't capture all that either, and it all ends up usually being trying to capture Trench H-12, it's nearly always H-12, which is just a poxy, useless trench. And that's mission creep. That's you don't know what you're doing. It's absolutely useless. And if you look at the Gallipoli plans, there's no well-defined goals. There's no real plan. There's under-trained troops. There's a lack of proper maps or intelligence, although they were there. It's just they didn't use them properly. Inadequate artillery support. No, the wrong uniforms and equipment for the top climber. Terrible supply arrangements. The enemy were grossly underestimated. Communications were all over the place. Some of the local British commanders were useless. There's the ludicrous overconfidence despite that. And then inevitable disaster, which culminates at Gallipoli in December and January of the end of the year, humiliating retreat. And that's just pretty well inevitable from the first day, as far as I can see. The real winners are the Turks, and the real losers are pretty well everybody who was there, because it was not a good place to go. Disease, death, killing, misery.
What are the bigger consequences? I mean, you're sort of tapping into it there about how this was, I'm going to use a technical term that we do love here on History Hack. This was shithousery from start to finish.
Yes.
Alex has trained me well, as you can tell. But what happens, you know, certainly to some of these people who were making these decisions in the longer term?
Well, it ends Hamilton's career. It ends Churchill's career. If we had a country that could recognise him, you know, he was finished for years. But he is so competent and so powerful a politician. Within a year or so, he's wormed his way back in. Hamilton's career is over. He only dies in about 1948. It's weird to think of him being that's only 7 years before I was born, sort of thing. Perhaps some of his reincarnated spirit. Ooh.
Not quite his love child, though.
No, not quite.
You do have a similar shaped head, to be fair.
Aylmer Hunter Weston, who was very bright but unpleasant and individual capable of horrendous stupidity, he goes to the Western Front, where he's a corps commander, and he's used mainly, after messing up on the Somme a bit, he's mainly used for training. Haig rates him as a training and a steady hand for holding the line, but not for doing any bigger offensives. So, but the real, I mean, it's what I like to look at is, if we hadn't gone to Gallipoli, did it make a difference, the whole campaign? I think that's one of the things Alex wanted me to think about. And the answer to me is, not really. And does one interesting thing is...
I always thought it makes us go into Salonika, because would we not have just said to the French, this is stupid, had they not backed us over this idiocy?
I think possibly, but I don't know. That we're very wavery. But we haven't learnt any lessons from Gallipoli, nor of the French, and we get sucked into the campaign. Serbia was our allies, and that's why we go into Salonika. But one thing I like to reflect on is partly because of where I come from in the country. Did it affect the Western Front? Well, the answer to that is two-part. One, no, because the forces engaged were either untrained and wouldn't have been deployed for years anyway, another year at least, or two, They weren't there. They'd have been in the Middle East anyway. So, but one thing is the 29th Division would have been there because they should have been on the Western Front. That's where they were meant to be going before Kitchener changed his mind 87 times. And I always had to think, I'm from the Northeast. I don't sound like it, but my family are. And some of my great uncles were in the 50th Division. And they were deployed during a German gas attack on the 22nd of April. Is it, Alex, you know better than me. 22nd of April, the big German gas attack at Ypres, second battle of Ypres. And the untrained 50th, relatively untrained 50th Division are forced to be deployed because there's nobody else.
Yeah.
I think that should have been the 29th Division. But did it affect the war? Not really. Mm. It's stupid and it causes a lot of loss of lives. It gives the Turks chance to kill lots and lots of British people that they wouldn't have had otherwise. But did it affect the actual course of the war? I don't think it did. To be honest, it was a failure. If it had succeeded, would it have affected the war? Well, I don't think it could have. And that is not hindsight. Look at the correspondence from people like Jellicoe, Haig, other senior people who are saying, what are they doing? It's not all hindsight. In 1906, they looked at the plans to do a Gallipoli campaign and take the Dardanelles, and they decided it was nigh on impossible. It hadn't changed. That is not hindsight. That is pre-sight. Is that a word?
It is now. One thing we haven't mentioned, Petey, just because we're on inclusive history now, and otherwise we'll get screamed at by woke people, India are there too, aren't they?
Yes, very, very, very much, definitely. And of course, there are people from all over Newfoundland. The Indians play a magnificent part in the campaign. There's a brigade, 29th Brigade of Indian troops. Fantastic performance. The Zion Mule Corps,
yep,
who were recruited, they're there. There's a huge, and let's not forget it, Irish contingent there.
Mm-hmm.
A 10th Irish Division are there. But a lot of the landings at V Beach were conducted by Irish troops, the Munsters. There's a lot of Scots, 52nd Lowland Division are there. People suffer from all. And then of course, the French army is sort of made up a bit like our colonial forces. So they have metropolitan troops from France, but then they have the French Foreign Legion, who are from everywhere. They're hilarious in many ways. But they also have a large number of troops from North Africa. So this is not just the British suffering. This is many of the Allies, and many of them. The French fight hard and well. It's my opinion, by the way, that the French probably killed more Turks than the rest of us put together. Because why? Because they had proper artillery and their bombardments were lethal, and we relied in our attacks on that French artillery often. There you go. Gallipoli, failure.
Destined always to be a failure as well.
Yes, in my view.
Peter, this has been, well, peerless, frankly. I'm going to resist the temptation to suck up too badly, but thank you.
Get a room, you two, really.
Thank you for coming on. We could sit here and publicise all of your works, but to be honest, we'd need another half hour to do it. People, just go Google Peter Hart. Actually, no, go to the History Hack bookstore and then go buy all of his books. Do that.
And stay tuned on History Hack, because we'll give you details of how you can come and meet Petey at his fabulous book launch in November. Because, Petey, you're working on a book. You are doing one about the Wrong War, but also as well, you've got military humour, which you've done with Gary.
Yeah, it's called Laugh or Cry, and it's about how soldiers cope in action, about how, well, they've got a choice, they can either laugh or cry. And we've looked at the laughing side. It's a weird book because a lot of it's very macabre, very dark humour. And I think it brings to light the stoicism of the British soldier. It is mainly British, this one, because that's what the sources were. And yeah, we're launching it on 11th of November. It's somewhere in London. But our venue's a bit in the air at the moment. And we'll be publicising.
We've got to find somewhere where you haven't annoyed people, haven't we?
That's it. Well, OK. It's myself and Gary Bain of Pete and Gary's Military History that have done it. Gary's equal partner in writing the book and of course in the podcasts, which are not rivals to History Hack, because we're only weekly. We're weekly, as in we're not very strong, and we're also weekly as we're once a week.
And also we're all
once a week's enough for any man. Yeah. I just thought carry on, just stall out and carry on, Doctor. PC. Once a week's enough for any man.
And when you do go to the History Act bookstore, this man has written a very fat book. It's a spider killer on Gallipoli. And also more recently, a book specifically about the evacuations. And he has also just done for us very kindly an introduction for the Great War Group series of introductions on Gallipoli. So there's plenty this man has written about this campaign if you want to see and hear him ranting more about what a colossal waste of time it was. Pete, thanks very much.
Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.